Welcome to Playful Beginnings, a podcast about the magic of play therapy for therapists, students, and anyone interested. In our podcast, we'll explore the deeper understanding of play therapy and the skills we use when working with children.
We hope to help you understand the why behind what we do and how it helps kids heal and grow. I'm Dr. Christy Opiola, a working play therapist and university professor in North Carolina.
I'm Dr. Maggie Parker, a play therapist and professor in DC. How are you, Christy?
I'm good. How are you, Maggie?
I am okay. If I'm going to be really honest, it's been a tough week. I just got back from South Dakota to celebrate my Uncle Kelly's life. So shout out to Kelly Hodge and his family. He was a really wonderful uncle and a really unexpected death. So,
yeah,
you know,
it's always a like a juxtaposition to celebrate while you're also grieving.
It is. It's really strange. But in full play therapy authenticity, that's where I'm at right now. I'm like, I got home late last night. And so if you're watching this, that's why my eyes are puffy.
Oh, is this live? Because I did not know. I mean, visually.
No, I mean, who knows? Sometimes I put it, like, I try and put the video up on YouTube, but sometimes it doesn't. So I guess if this is just audio, y'all can know that my eyes are puffy. And Christy and I are in our end of semester.
I was going to say, in true authenticity, we're both just recovering from finishing a semester too. So, and getting ready for the holidays. So,
yes, it is a crazy time.
It is a little bit of a, it's not unsettling. It's just, it's always rushed, it feels like.
It feels really rushed. And I'm sure for those that are working, like for, you know, parents and teachers and play therapists, this can be a really tough time for everybody because kids are dysregulated. Right. There's a lot of like deadlines, like whichever holiday you are celebrating, there are things that come with that, like even just like cleaning the house and gathering food and getting all of the traditions going to create that holiday magic. So
yes, all that jazz. I was sharing with a colleague yesterday. I listened to someone on YouTube. Her name's Rebecca McDonough. She's a teacher and she calls it the Bermuda Triangle of holidays, right? It starts with Halloween, then you get Thanksgiving and then Christmas and children and families and teachers. Everyone's dysregulated at this time. And, you know, we're at the end of the Bermuda Triangle. So like the dysregulation is at all time highs.
Oh, yeah. It's a peak. Yes. And it's interesting. I've been looking at some of the play therapy supports within Facebook, and actually the current president of the Virginia Association for Play Therapy reached out to me. And for those who don't know, Christy is the current president of the North Carolina Play Therapy Association. And so she knows Sarah also. So shout out to Sarah Herrig. And she asked if we could talk about this idea of kind of trusting the process. I think we discussed like throughout the podcast about child-centered play therapy and how we adapt what we do as opposed to what we think based on developmental stages. But I do see a lot of people saying like, oh, I'm working with a child with X, Y, and Z, or I've been working with them for 2 months and it's child-centered isn't working. So what do I need to do to augment that? And I think you and I both have pretty strong reactions to that. Not in an ugly way, just I think that you and I have both experienced that feeling of hitting a wall and a desire to reach out and do something different. And so I also think that you and I have remained pretty true despite those feelings because of the supports and training that we received. I think really, especially when we were in grad school, that's when a lot of this came up. And we had the supports of really well, you know, seasoned play therapists who were able to kind of hold our hand through that process. And so maybe we can kind of provide that for some of our listeners who may be feeling the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, I've definitely been there. I can share that I've, you know, sometimes been there recently around clients that challenge us in session and the questioning, is this enough? Does the child need something else? And I know for myself, one of the greatest kind of support that I got was to really reflect internally about where is that coming from for me? And it comes from all different places, right? Are you feeling pressure from a caregiver in this child's life, a teacher, a parent, where it's been a particularly hard week? Are you in a hard spot yourself? So, you know, Maggie just shared that she's currently grieving the loss of a loved one. So we're going to show up a little differently in the room when those things happen. And I think we live in a society that wants instant gratification, instant change. And so I think sometimes we're quick to throw our hands up and say we need to do something that is more directive. And I'm not saying that the more directive roles may not benefit a client, but if you're going to stay true to child-centered, right, it gives a really confusing message to a child that you trust them and then you don't trust them. And
Right.
you express why you've switched roles, you just come in differently. And I think that can be really confusing and off-putting to a child, just like it would be if you were partnered with someone and all of a sudden they came home and they were acting totally different, or if they were always super supportive and listening, and then all of a sudden they come home barking orders or directing you or telling you how to handle it, you're going to be like, whoa, 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 where did this come from? I think children react the same way in the playroom when we make that sudden switch without, like really a thoughtful rationale, a plan about how we're going to discuss it with kids, those types of things.
Yeah, I think that's helpful too. I was listening to Brenna Hicks's podcast, and she was talking about almost like the opposite of like going from directive to non-directive, and really the importance of talking with the child through that. And it's sometimes, I don't know, like when I've had those moments of, oh, this isn't working, or the anxiety or fear that it's not working, my first thought isn't, how can I let the kid know that I'm doing something different? It's just like, oh, I need to go in and be different. And it can be really discombobulating for a child. And I think you're absolutely right, is if we're sending this message for, 6, 12 weeks, I trust you. And then we come in and we're like, okay, now we're going to do something different. That could be really disheartening as well to the child.
I think we also have to be thoughtful, like theoretically, like how kids would internalize that. Because if within child-centered, we have this belief of like they have this natural desire towards growth, right? We call it the actualizing tendency, or the OVP, right? Like, which is really helping to push them to be their best self. Yet they receive messages from the community or from loved ones or people in their lives that that's not good enough. So they alter themselves because we also are just naturally wired to want to be in relationship and receive love. And so if all of a sudden I change and I'm different, I often wonder, like, what is the internal message kids receive? I think it's confirming, right? Maybe what their presenting concern was, like, oh, yeah, I'm so messed up. Look, Miss Maggie tried to trust me and try to give me space, and I'm not good enough to, right? Like, does it reinforce that condition of worth that has been, like that they've created in their upbringing or in their experiences? And then, like anything, like when we talk about boundaries or discipline, right? It's not the first time you do it that it works. It's the consistency and the predictability. So if we're all of a sudden gonna change, then we're no longer predictable or consistent for the child. So just to me, often when I've had to reflect upon it for myself, like I go back to that, like, what is this kid's undergirding that they think about themselves or think about the world or think about other people? And if I change how I'm going to behave, right, by taking a directive approach or finding a module or doing worksheets on something, am I inadvertently reinforcing those conditions of worth that they kind of set for themselves? And so I don't know, like from a theoretical side, that's what I often think about. I can share personally on some of these occasions, like when I've sought mentorship or I've sought just guidance, because I've really, and don't be fooled that Maggie and I don't question ourselves, because
Oh.
I think it happens more from a child-centered lens, because there's a lot of faith, right? Not only in what we're providing, but also a lot of faith in the other person. And when things don't appear to be shifting right away, right? Sometimes we start to question our faith in ourselves or others. And so, I
Well,
also,
oh, go
go
ahead.
ahead. No,
Well,
no, no.
so I was gonna say, really, I think the first thing that I do when I'm starting to feel that way, and I'm able to feel it. I feel things very somatically. I'm also a very like empathic person, and so I feel a lot of feelings all the time, right? So I have to be really like introspective as to like, okay, what am I feeling right now? And then as I'm exploring that, what is this that's creating it, right? So is it anxiety because the teachers are coming to me and they're like, they're not getting better, they're not coming, they acted out in class, so they're not going to come to play therapy today, or why aren't you teaching them this? Or I've had parents who have been like, but why are you just playing with them? They need to work on executive functioning skills. You need to teach them these things. And parents are paying a lot of money, right, to come and see us, especially in the area that I am in. A lot of this is out of pocket. And so that's a lot of money, and this can take longer. And then sometimes it's when I feel, and this is when I have to be really careful of, when I feel out of control and I'm wanting to create some semblance of control. Because if I go in and I say, we're going to do this today, that puts me back in control. And sometimes when I feel anxious or discombobulated, it makes, like, when I'm under stress, I like to feel like I'm in control. And so really trying to examine what's going on for me here, and is this to serve me or is this to serve the child? And that's where I have to come back to my core understanding of, or my core beliefs about children, about change, about my role, and really kind of recenter and ground myself in that, because I don't need to be in control in this space. I am in control of the way I show up and the way that I provide empathy and care and reflection to help this, you know, children understand themselves and discover themselves in a way that benefits them. And but it's not for me to control their progress. And I think what's really helpful from this perspective is, like, not only am I you know, I'm trusting the process, but I'm also meeting them where they are, and then I'm the different type of adult than anyone else, right? And I have to remind myself they have teachers teaching them social emotional skills. They have parents teaching them social emotional skills, but they're bringing them to me because I'm different. And I have to remind myself of that.
Yeah, as you were talking, it's really, I think, when we're saying self-reflection, right? It's like, am I being congruent and authentic in this relationship, or what parts of me have been triggered that are forcing me to want to do or show up differently for this kid? And that could be external pressure. That could also be internal, like Maggie talked about, right? Like, if I have a high need for control and I feel out of control in a session or,
In life, because you've experienced
yeah, or life, or
stuff.
like things aren't going the way you were hoping that they would go, right? So like you, I think that shows up subtly. But like doing a deep dive of like what's happening for me in this moment, what am I, why all of a sudden do I feel all of this pressure, or why do I feel the need, and what is that about, right? And looking at it both from potentially what's happening in the child's life, or what's happening, you know, like in my personal life, or me personally. Sometimes it comes up because they're my last client of the day and I'm tired, right? And we try to provide the same thing for every one of our clients. But if you see six or seven clients in a day, do you show up the same for your first client as you do your last client? Or just the emotional toll, right? Like shifts what that looks like. And is that fair to each of your, you know, depending on, is it fair that your last client always gets less of you, right? And so you tend to want to direct more, or you tend to want to go somewhere else. And I also love what you said, Maggie, about, I think all of us would agree that therapy is just a different environment. And if I'm mimicking what everyone else is mimicking, how am I providing something different for this child? Which has been something that always resonated with me as a child-centered or person-centered clinician, that how am I showing up differently here? How are they experience this relationship differently than they experience other relationships? Or does it feel like any other relationship that they have? And not that that isn't therapeutic, that's just not person-centered.
Right. And I think you also brought up, am I being authentic? Am I being true? Am I being genuine? And so if child-centered doesn't feel true or authentic and genuine, that is okay. And you can, you know, align with a different theoretical orientation. But where I struggle is when people are like, I'm child-centered, and now I'm going to bring in this, because those are really antithetical. I think when we get back to child-centered, the relationship is necessary and sufficient. So if you are, you know, engaging in a different theoretical approach, whatever that approach may be, you're not using CCPT and another approach because you're providing the core conditions. Those core conditions are really relevant across theoretical orientations, unless you're strictly behaviorist, right? And so it's, you're not using person-centered, and you are valuing the relationship, which is a part of that theoretical orientation. If you're child-centered, then you are going to be non-directive, and you're going to stick less directive and stick with that through those hard things. And then I think where it becomes different in the way in which you and I approach these situations, potentially from other theoretical orientations, is instead of saying, this is coming up for me. What do I need to do in the room differently? I think the question that we get supervision and consultation on is, this is coming up for me. What's going on so I can remain true in this space? And I think those are pretty different ways of approaching that situation. And I think I remember, I mean, I think we have this a lot, actually, and you and I both reach out to each other quite often when we're like, I'm feeling overwhelmed. I'm feeling like this isn't going anywhere. And what I find to be really helpful is it's not simply someone saying, trust the process. You'll challenge me and say, okay, what's going on for you in this moment? Tell me about what's going on for this child. And what I really appreciate too, is that most times it allows me to see the child differently, which then helps me show up in that space more authentically and in alignment with that theoretical approach.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I do want to just review really quick, because sometimes we throw out terms because they're so familiar to us, right? But core conditions.
Yes.
Right, within child-centered or really attitudinal conditions of the therapist is what Maggie is sharing is universal across most theoretical approaches. They're just not sufficient across most theoretical approaches. So what she's talking about is like the counselor's congruence, right? Like our authenticity, that we know what is ours, right? So our triggers, the things that like kind of get under our skin that are going to cause us to react in certain ways, maybe stuff that's happening in our lives that are impacting our ability to show up with this client or to be really present with this client. So that's congruence. The second one is unconditional positive regard, which is valuing the humanness of the client, really like believing in the client in that moment. And then empathic responding is being able to share our understanding from a feeling perspective of what's happening, of we're kind of mirroring what the client shares with us.
Mm-hmm.
And so speaking to that mirroring of, and we do that mainly through reflections. We can also do that through tracking behaviors. And so we find that true across all of the theoretical orientations, but again, it's sufficient in child-centered, which means we don't believe you need to add something in addition to that. And if the client can feel those three conditions, that's when change can occur. They have to experience it to a minimal degree. And the more of a degree they experience, potentially the quicker change can happen. And some of our clients really have maybe mistrusting relationships, or it's hard for them to trust what they're experiencing. And so it could be slower, but that's really going to be dependent on the kiddo. The one other thing I wanted to say is, you know, giving unconditional positive regard requires us to give that to ourselves too, which is unconditional positive self-regard, which is really hard to do.
Yeah.
But if kind of like the analogy of the oxygen mask in an airplane, like if we don't provide it for ourselves, how do we provide it for our clients? Like truly. And so like if we need ourselves to change to be better, like do we actually portray that to our clients more often, is that we need them to be slightly different instead of, you know, valuing them as who they are. We might not appreciate the behavior or the response or an interaction, right? But that doesn't mean I care less about who this person is. Or I disregard them totally. Or
and I think it's really hard to do. I think it's like when we think about this, like, oh, we can all establish relationships. Clearly we're in the helping field. And yes, I am very relational by nature. And it is very hard for me. It takes up a lot of emotional and mental energy when I'm in that space, because I'm constantly trying to be remaining focused while also kind of like checking internally as I'm going through the session and responding empathically and understanding and caring for this person as they're experiencing these things. It's an attitudinal shift. I think it's a shift in how we understand people. And one of the things that I found to be really helpful for me in understanding what we do, and I share this a lot with parents and teachers and students, is when I accept you for who you are, I give you permission to change. And if you think about—
Right. I give you permission to show up authentically, right? Like to not show up masked or not to show up with like expectations that others have for you, but I allow you to like really be who you are without having
to change that. Like, I think that's the thing, is like, if I have someone coming up to me and they're like, hey, listen, you're actually not very nice and you're not very smart and you need to do X, Y, and Z, Or if I kind of make the analogy of when you go home, right? Like you go to your hometown and you see people who you don't have authentic relationships with and you don't really trust that actually care about you, you're not going to tell them everything that's happening in your life. You're going to be very selective in what you provide. And because you don't trust them to truly care and be able to hold those things. And so kids aren't going to be able to come to us and share those things that they're struggling with, or, they're going to put up that mask if they don't think that, if they think that underlying ourselves is that they aren't good the way they are, like that all of their things that they're scared of or fearful of, or that they believe other people don't like about them or that aren't acceptable about them. If they think that I'm also upholding that judgment, they're never going to show me that. And why would they? They shouldn't. It's not a safe space to do that. And it's really hard to really genuinely have unconditional positive regard. And it's, I think that's probably the things I get supervision on the most. It's like, I'm really struggling with empathizing right now. And so you help me. And Casey Lee has been really instrumental in this for me. Also, Dr. Casey Lee at Lipscomb University, of helping me reframe, like, okay, wait, let's look at it. So this is what's bothering you. And this is what this child's going through. And it allows me to shift and then become more accepting in that space. I think it's also important to note that we're not just being in relationship, right? We're not just like what is it? Like lumps on a log, bumps on a log. What is
Oh,
it?
no, we're not passive. We don't sit there and do nothing.
We're very active. We are reflecting and responding and enlarging the meaning and recognizing feelings and being a mirror in a way that the child can see themselves differently, but that's developmentally appropriate way to do that. And I think you and I are very consistent in how we do that with adults and teenagers too, is we're providing reflections that are mirroring back what the client is saying or doing or engaging or experiencing that helps them kind of, I guess, when I think about it with adults, like reorients the way I'm thinking about things, that light bulb moment of like, oh, this looks differently than I thought that it did. I think I'm not expressing that as well as I should. Like,
I agree. I was just going to take it from a slightly different angle, right? Like, as I accept you for exactly who you are, and I'm not asking you to be different with me, right? Like, I think what happens in session is kids start to take little risks. They start to show harder parts, more vulnerable parts, more emotionally tender parts of themselves, right? And so as the therapist is able to reflect that back to the child without judgment, without like direction of like, oh, then you should do this or you should do that. I think what starts to happen is the child then starts to recognize that as, oh, I can, whatever it might be, have an opinion. I can be messy. I can
be sad or angry.
be bad, or I can show you how out of control my life feels right now, right? Like, oh, I can throw this object in your playroom. Right. Or, like, even if they can't throw that object, it's not that we're saying you can't throw. We're just saying that object is not something to throw because it might break. Right. So you can choose something else to throw. Right. Because it sounds, you're really angry. You need to show us how angry you are. And so we're able to reflect that in a way so that they can, like, internally express themselves and then really try on, does this fit for me or does this not fit for me? And if this doesn't fit for me, what would feel more true to who I am in this moment? And so then, like, we kind of keep bringing up, we call this relational depth in therapy, right? Like, where we can get deeper into what's really happening internally. There those real tender parts so that we can be more real. We can
Be vulnerable.
be vulnerable and authentic and conscientious of that I'm showing up. And, oh, Miss Maggie, she likes me, even though I have anger. Miss Maggie is okay that I can put all the toys on the playroom on the floor because this is what my life feels like right now. Like that she's not telling me it needs to be picked up right away. She's not even telling me I have to clean it up, right? Like she's allowing me to let this mess be in this moment. I would also say I'm thinking of a particular client that probably tested my trusting the process the most. And there were times that I would say I would get triggered by what she would say or do, right? And like I would react in the moment instead of respond. So I would like, that wasn't nice, or why did you do that? Right. Like, so I would be more reactionary than responsive. And it's my responsibility as a therapist to repair that in the moment. So she's not stuck thinking about what's happening right now. Right. Like, oh, so she really doesn't accept me. No, you know what? That really kind of hit a tender spot for me. And I reacted to you. That was not my intention. Right. I'm not for talking that way, or that toy is not for doing that. Instead of the kid just wondering and internalizing it as themselves. I think those were really, for this client, critical moments in our relationship. And I also needed a lot of guidance because
it was hard.
This was a school-aged kiddo who basically did not like my existence. Did not.
You were the worst.
I was the worst. And she would tell me how bad I was, even to the point like, you breathe loud. Why do you do this? Why do you do that? Why do you dress like that? Why do you eat like literally like questioning my whole existence in our relationship, which is, I really think, was a projection from her about how she felt from other people. So she just mimicked it towards me about, right. And me holding true to reflecting those components for her, like, oh, you really don't like the way I talk. You don't like the way I wear my hair. You would dress differently, right? Which is no front to me or no front to her. It's just a fact that she felt very inclined to share with me. And I remember I was at UNT at the time and going to one of our advisors and kind of sharing like, oh my gosh, maybe child-centered isn't the right approach for this kid. I also, Gary Landreth talks a lot about intervening moments. And I found that happening in this case in particular, that something would happen that would indicate, like on our hardest sessions, something would happen that would indicate to me what I was doing actually was working. So like this kid, you can imagine she probably didn't have a lot of friends, right? Or didn't get invited very many places, but got invited to her first birthday party, or the teacher would report to me something in our consultation, like she took an initiative and, you know, she thoughtfully helped me here or did this, which is really a change in behavior for her. Or a parent saying, we made it the whole car ride without, you know, this client initiating a fight with their siblings in the back of the car. Like there was no argument. Like when we got home, we were almost like holding our breath because we just couldn't believe that this had happened. And those I needed to hear, because uniquely, sometimes we're the first to see change, or a lot of times we're the first to see change, but we can also be the last to see change. And like, I'm going to be honest, I saw her for a year and she never changed for me, and she changed for every other human that she interacted with. So I was the person she could safely project and still be accepted, which gave her, I believe, the strength to make shifts in her other relationships.
When I think it also, oh, sorry, you're going to keep going.
Nope. No, I wasn't.
I think it also highlights the fact that it can be incremental change. It doesn't always have to be this huge, big thing. And I've been working with some supervisees right now on like what their goals are for the therapeutic process. And I might say, you know, reduce emotional outbursts by one time per week. And they're like, okay. And so after a while, they're like, well, we met that goal. I'm like, that's awesome. That is so great. That's so wonderful. So it's either, okay, are we done? Because we've met this goal, or this is going too slow. We're not meeting our goals fast enough. And I'm like, okay, so it needs to be small goals that are attainable.
And
we
measurable.
Need to recognize that they are happening and they're measuring, and then you can increase those goals, right? So like the goal is that they're not that they never have emotional outbursts, because we're human and we all have emotional outbursts, but recognizing that change can build upon itself, and it often happens incrementally. And so really recognizing when some of the small changes begin, and helping parents and teachers and ourselves see those small changes, is really important.
Which I think is another topic we can probably talk about, Maggie, is like, how do we measure change in therapy from a child-centered perspective?
I'll put that on the list.
I think there's several ways we both kind of probably measure change similarly and different. Right. So maybe talking a little bit about that, but I will give a plug for Dr. Sue Redden. She has a weekly parent report form that can be incredibly helpful, where you take those goals, you create it. And before I jump into it, I do want to say what we say we want to see weekly may not be our big goal overall, right? Those might just be the measurable goals, right? And so maybe we want to go from 5 outbursts a day, you know, to like 3 or 4 a week, but we're going to start the measuring, right? It can't be all or nothing. Like no one's going to change that quickly. And so it's those small incremental changes that can be really helpful to us, right, over time. And so, yeah, maybe I want to start by measuring it one time less per week, but my ultimate goal is to get it down to maybe just 2 or 3 times. And that really happens in your initial goal setting with the parent. Like what is their goal for this kid in therapy? Like what would they ultimately like to see? And again, it can't be all or nothing because no one is ever going to be nothing, right? And so it's just about what is livable and would make life more peaceful, more relational for you, more connective with your child. Would you be able to manage, you know, 2 or 3 tantrums a week compared to 5 a day?
Right.
You know, that sounds really doable. Or, you know, like teachers seeing less outburst, you know, slowly over time, but kids outburst in school. That's just a normal childhood behavior. So we don't want to take childhood out of kids. We just want to make it more in the developmental norm. But back to Sue's parenting worksheet, her weekly report form, it's not part of the record, but it is a form parents fill out each week. You have the goals and they Likert scale measure how the kid is doing in goals. And what we see is it's bumpy, right? Like kids have good weeks, kids have bad weeks. We can typically pin those to something else going on in the child's life over time. And the other thing we see is that when we're swimming in it with our kids, that it's sometimes hard to be an objective observer. So very subtle change, but we can see a shift, you know, instead of it always being a 10, all of a sudden it's closer to, you know, like a 9 or an 8. And that's a change. I want to make sure we note that to parents, like something small has happened where there's this subtle shift. It's also a reminder to us that subtle shifts have happened, that then like we can go back and say, okay. So things are shifting a little bit to allow us to trust the process more. That form also allows parents to let you know when they really need to meet with you or like something major, or they can let you know of a major event that's happened in the child's life, a change in medication. It could, you know, like you can fill that form in lots of different ways, but I do find that form, I have found it professionally very helpful for parents. And I have it just at the beginning of the school year when they sell those really cheap notebooks, you know, the ones with things, I just put it in there and I have a whole bunch. And then I just have a flag and that I move each week. So it goes to the next week so they can just open it, flag it. But when we do parent consultations, I can actually chart it for them. I find graphing is really helpful so parents can see the visual change that's happening or the decrease in behaviors, even if subtle.
Yeah, no, that's a great resource that I haven't used and I should use and I will use. I also think it speaks to something that you and I have seen in the research that we've done. So Christy and I have done a couple meta-analyses, which is when you look at studies across the board, like about child-centered, and then you combine them all together to see if overall it's effective. So it's a really helpful tool for research and to show efficacy. And so we just completed one with children who've experienced trauma in child-centered play therapy, and I completed one with disruptive behaviors. And what was really interesting for both of them that we had to kind of discuss and have conversations about is that child-parent relationship therapy actually had higher effect sizes than child-centered play therapy. And when you think about this with children who are expressing externalizing behaviors or have experienced trauma, it takes a long time to trust a therapist to show those things, right? Whether it's because of the trauma and in fear about attachment to a new person, or because these are behaviors that people are harping on all the time. Externalizing behaviors are the ones that teachers and parents are really like, you know, stop, which understandable. They're hard to experience. And then the research, it's usually what, like 16 to 24 sessions. And so that may not be enough time. And so remembering when you're having these moments of maybe this isn't working right, remind yourself that this child is working to trust you and your relationship and your positive, unconditional positive regard for them and your authenticity, if this is something that you will accept and that they can bring to you. And so sometimes that does take longer. And so it's not necessarily that you're doing something wrong or you need to add something to it to make it it go faster. It's that they're determining if you are trustworthy. And if you were to shift in the middle of that experience, that can really impact their level of trust of you, because now it's shifted and it's scary.
I also sometimes wonder if the CPRT research shows higher effectiveness is also because there's more consistency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, both if they've seen a therapist or if they haven't, you know, a parent has the ability to be more consistent for longer periods of time over multiple days a week, mm-hmm. right? Than when we just see them one day a week. Or right. It's the combination of them getting individual and child-centered and, right, like, so there's a consistent pattern in how people are interacting with me, trusting me, reflecting for me, that makes that change maybe more effective.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure.
I mean, and I think we can look at it.
Shifts parents' perspectives. And I think some what we're measuring are often parent perspectives.
Yeah.
Both of those things. But and yes.
It could be assessment. There could be a lot of reasons for this, but I do find it interesting and something I have to remind myself of like, okay, maybe. And I've seen, you know, kids who show up the same each week, very chaotic. And, you know, I've worked with kids who have like really intensive trauma, early childhood trauma and prenatal trauma, and also have been diagnosed with, you know, autism. And so it's like, okay. And I'll like, oh, I don't know if I can, you know, I know trauma, but I don't know ASD as much. And so maybe this isn't working. And they showed up each week doing the same things, just chaos, just everywhere chaos. And I'm, you know, reminding myself, like, this is their experience of their inner world. This is their processing. And in those moments when I would start to doubt myself and I would call you and have conversations, it's like, okay, can you trust the process? And usually when I allowed myself the space to relax and then continue to show up authentically, that's when the caregivers would say, you know, I'm noticing a big change. They're happier, or they're singing in the car. And there, you know, it doesn't mean that there aren't meltdowns. And I just tend to notice that in those moments when I do allow myself to just release that fear and trust the process and reinvigorate myself and reorient myself into this space, that's usually when I start to see change.
Yeah.
Which I think is just really interesting. And so I would encourage the play therapists that are listening and the parents who might be listening whose kids are in therapy of being like, okay, what's going on here, to take it back to where we started, like, what's going on with me that I want this change to happen? What could this mean for the child? How can I continue to show up in this space? And it's usually after that moment that you start to see changes, for me at least, anecdotally.
No, I agree.
It's like the doubts come right before it's like there's some cosmic connection, I think, just in general, that happens between the child and the play therapist. There's like this soul merging, or however you want to explain it, but there's a connection. And so I wonder if there's something about that where it's the child is feeling anxious because they're starting to explore and expand and are on the precipice of growth. And we are feeling that and feeling like we need to push it. But when we don't push it and allow it to come at the child's pace, then it starts to be demonstrated.
Yeah.
I had never really thought about it until I'm an external processor. So this is all new to me that's coming out of my mouth.
Well, and I also wonder if it's some of that anxiety that comes up in kids right before change happens, right? Like, which happens for us as adults too.
Mm-hmm.
Or we're going to do something big or different. We tend to have hesitancy. We tend to have higher feelings of anxiety and other stuff. Is that what our doubt is? That where we start to distrust the process? Because we're feeling that, right? Especially if we're empathic, we're feeling that in the client. And so then we start to question it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't seem different, but in trusting the process, right? Like, we can actually see that shift happen. And we have the honor of participating on that
mm-hmm.
for foot off the ledge kind of test to try something differently, or to be more vulnerable, or to say something more authentically, or whatever it might be that the child does, play out something that they've been holding on to for a long time.
Yeah. And that we're scared to change too, as adults. Like,
well, and I think the other thing around trusting the process is sometimes I think it's connected to our own competence and how competent we are feeling, or if our competence is being challenged, does that shift how I trust the process, right? Or my need, like, this I know I can do. right? Like I can be directive. I
That's
can guide people in certain ways. And sometimes that's an easier.
you feel more in control.
Yeah, I don't even know if it's fulfilling. I was like trying to think of the word, but like maybe it gives like a false assurance in the moment. I don't know.
No, but I think it's just really interesting to kind of think about this. And if people are listening, I think what I hope that they hear is one, that we experience that too. And, we've had a ton of training and we've been in practice for a really long time, and we feel that too. And we've continued to trust the process in face of that feeling, and we've seen it work. And so, really allowing yourself to explore what's going on for you and what's creating that change, and then maybe even challenging yourself to stay true and see where that takes you before maybe going to what else do I need to do?
I will say I'm in a community that is the clinicians here are child-centered and something else. And I think supervisors can be a really important component of this pathway. If your supervisor leans more person-centered, they're going to work you through that process. If they lean more directive or the and, they might lean you in a different direction. And just having talked to, clinicians in the field who may have started off feeling person-centered and felt really pushed to try other things, right? Like when you're self-doubting yourself or when you're not feeling very confident, it's easy to be directed away from like staying true. And then they've also talked about how they missed that part. And yes, this is helpful and it can maybe relieve something in the immediate. It doesn't feel long-term sustainable, right? And so, which is an interesting dynamic to be thoughtful of too, is if questioning, also know who you're getting support from, because that might also, because I think both of us would be in a different spot if we had supervisors who would have guided us to try a different technique or do EMDR or do something else with our clientele in the moment. And I want to reiterate, Maggie and I are not saying that those aren't effective interventions. All we're saying is for us, they didn't fit well, right? And that kind of staying true to our beliefs and that stuff, that we were able to stay more consistent and child-centered
Well,
or person-centered because of that support.
maybe it's something that like we can ask our listeners, like if this is something that you would like us to provide, like do you want to have communities where we can, provide some support from a really grounded CCBT perspective, that maybe that's something that we can start off and offering if our listeners are interested. And you can email us at playfulbeginningspodcast@gmail.com if you have suggestions or if this is something that you're interested in. And maybe we can, I think that's something that you and I have started exploring of if we want to do some trainings in CCBT or resources. And you can always go to the Center for Play Therapy for some really great resources and child-centered and trainings and stuff as well. But
Same
you're
with you in
right.
Charlotte. We have some trainings too down here in the Charlotte area that are both child-centered, but also other approach centered trainings. So
There are a lot of resources that we could provide.
or at least guide you, like where should I be looking if you're looking for
We have a pretty vast network, but
authentically child-centered. We also want to hear from you what topics. This topic came from one of our amazing listeners, Sarah, and friends. Thanks, Sarah. I think those are really sometimes helpful to guide us on what you want us to talk about. So please
You can
email.
email us, you can leave it in the reviews. The more reviews you provide us, the better we can kind of navigate, as this is a new experience for us. It's something that I think we both really enjoy. It's been really fun. And so
We kind of really geek out about talking child-centered. So
it's really fun. It's actually a big highlight of my week, being able to have these conversations. And these are conversations that Christy and I have, whether we're being recorded or not.
Talking on the phone.
Yeah, pretty much. This is something that we really care about and are passionate about. And so we would love to hear your thoughts and your perspectives and any potential questions or topics. So like, subscribe, and leave a review.
We love it, and we appreciate all of you.
Well, Christy, thank you for talking with me. Thank you for giving space for me to share some of what's happening, and I hope that you have a
Absolutely.
Yeah, I know. It was tough. So
Actually, might be recording next time in the same location, which is kind
I
of
know.
exciting.
It'll be so fun. So
More mischief
thank
to
you.
come.
Yes. Yeah. More. All right. Well, good luck with your end of semester grading and wrapping up all your play sessions before the new year. And we'll release them every Monday at 8 a.m.
Yes, and keep being playful, y'all.
Bye. I'm Dr. Maggie Parker, a play therapist and professor in DC.